Showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. So there I was, sitting right here where I am now, in the studio, pulling together a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and, you know, this moron and that moron, and, well, a couple of very special morons, and lo and behold, the power blinked. Now, understand, we got up to 65 degrees here today. The sky was just as blue as anything short of North Carolina can be. And everything, warm as toast, I mean, no wind, nothing. And all of a sudden, the electricity goes blink. And it was coming on toward 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so that meant it was dark. And we sat there for a minute, and it came back on and was gone within a second. Another minute passed by. It came back on, gone in less than half a second. Then it came on a fourth time, and, you know, usually the three blinks is the test, but no, it came back a fourth time, and then just, and I knew, nah, it ain't coming back for a while. Because, of course, we're talking about the Appalachian Power Company, which depends on an ancient coal-fried early 20th century technology grid, and they're just not very good at the whole providing electricity thing. Now, they're really good at gouging the hell out of their consumers when they spend too much money on coal, and they're especially good at passing profits along to their godforsaken shareholders. But they are not worth a fuck at delivering electric power. Nope. I mean, I guess the one thing they've got going for them is they haven't burned down the state yet. I mean, so they've got that over PG&E. But, and so 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time came and went, no program. And about 15 minutes ago, it came back. It wasn't supposed to be back until 12:40 this morning, but it's back. I hope it stays that way, although there is no guarantee. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live on the interweb tubes. That's your home for all your horn podcasting needs. It's also where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room. Only two folks in there this evening, but there's no such thing as only. Anatole and Squeaky hung around even though an hour passed, and just the same, we were here. So thanks for hanging around, Squeaky and Anatole. If you'd like to wander on by, well, feel free to do so. Go to headon.live, click on chat room, and away you'll go, assuming you've got a screen name and a password. And if you don't, well, just pick one out for free. Whatever you feel like being out here in the interweb tube wilderness. Well, thank you, Jim. Jim says, wow, good luck. Well, you know, it's Appalachian Power. We'll probably need no small amount of it. This program, like every other here at the Horn, begins with gratitude. And so thanks go out over the weekend. By the way, I realized something. I didn't know it before. The 9th of the month is now the loneliest subscriber day on the calendar. Khalil is holding down the subscriber duties all by himself on the 9th of the month. For the 10th, thanks going out to Don and Judy and Daniel. And then, of course, for the 11th of the month, thanks go out to Paul from Parts Unknown, to Mary Bell, to Tony and Chico, to our buddy Christopher, who turned me on to the Pico Fruta from Penzi's. And then the Pico Fruta was kindly provided to me by an anonymous member of the community. And John, thank you to John for being a subscriber. Thanks to all of you for being partial sponsors of the program. Thank you so very much. I got a Pico Fruta update. I've tried it on everything. I tried it on apples. I've tried it on berries. I've tried it on strawberries. I've tried it on oranges. And yes, I've tried it on mango. I've tried it on pineapple. I tried it on a banana. It was even good on a banana. I can't imagine a fruit out there that's it's not good on. And I even took it a step further, and I tried it on avocado. Holy mackerel. Magnificent. So, A, thanks to Christopher for the recommendation, and thanks to our anonymous friend for providing a taste. It will be used frequently, I can assure you. So, yum, yum. It is Moran Monday on the Horn, and so thanks to our subscribers, we're in a bit of a spot because we finished the week $70 behind last week, and this week is a short week for fundraising, and it's a short week for programs, for that matter, because I'm gone Thursday and Friday. Back to the ordinary schedule come Monday. So, what it boils down to is Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, and we've got a $1,070 fundraising goal. Now, what that works out to in terms of ciphering out per evening, I'm almost terrified to even contemplate. But contemplate we shall. So, let's see, 1070 divide by 3 equals $356.66. We'll, you know what? We'll just forget about the $6.66, and we'll just call it $350 an evening. Because, well, there's bills to pay that come due at the middle of the month, and the middle of the month is rapidly approaching. So that's where fundraising stands. And if we can meet that, then there's only one more week of it, and then fundraising free radio for the end of the month, during which we will have, among other things, Thanksgiving week. I see no reason why I won't be on the air for Thanksgiving night. I was last year. I think I was the year before, too. So we'll all just get together and be a little bit drowsy. Maybe we'll have Thanksgiving on the front porch or something, and just be a little bit drowsy as the tryptophan from the turkey kicks our asses. Which leads us to the fact that it is Moran Monday. And, well, I'm hard-pressed to figure out where to start it. But you know where my heart lies, at least this time of year. It lies with my beloved Mountaineers, who got the living bejesus thumped out of them by Texas Tech. And I've always had my other alma mater, my alma mater, the University of Alabama, to fall back on because they have a respectable football program. But they fucked themselves this weekend. I kid you not. I mean, I watched, and this is not about sports. Stop it. This is Moran Monday. This is a Moran nomination. So I watched the game, and I watched them introduce Nitwit Nero and the First Lady Melanoma, the only First Lady in the history of the United States ever to remove her clothing in exchange for money for the sexual gratification of absolute strangers. And desperate for someone to cheer for him, well, and having been threatened in advance with having their seat, their football seat in the stadium taken away from them if they dared to boo him, oh, they cheered lustily for Nitwit Nero down in T-Town. They did. And shortly after the introduction with the University of Alabama Crimson Tide driving into the red zone, they fumbled. And so the mighty Crimson Tide went into the locker room at the half, trailing the Louisiana State University 33-13. And they battled back heroically, trying to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. But it wasn't enough. And the University of Alabama Crimson Tide lost its first game at home in 31 games. 31 home games they've won in a row. 31 home games where the stadium named after that among the greatest of all football coaches, Paul William Bear Bryant of Fordyce, Arkansas, who was dirt poor and scrabbled his way up from being a dirt farmer's son to earn himself a scholarship at the University of Alabama, and then went on to a legendary coaching career. The first time that Donald Trump entered entered the stadium named for Paul Bear Bryant, well, the Alabama Crimson Tide lost their first football game in more than 31 games. And so the Crimson Tide faithful have no one to blame but themselves. Washington Nationals fans booed Nitwit Nero. They won the World Series. Look, I'm usually not a big superstition guy, but if there's anywhere where I do give credence to a little bit of superstition, it's in the world of sports. You know, lucky socks and things like that. And so that happened. And then today, and by the way, to all the veterans out there, if not a happy, then a peaceful and contemplative Veterans Day to you. I hope you've had a good day. It began, of course, as Armistice Day at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, when the carnage and slaughter of the trenches finally came to a close. And people like Woodrow Wilson started blathering about making the world safe for democracy. But of course, there was a petty, pissant, jealous Republican senator by the name of Henry Cabot Lodge who refused to go along with the League of Nations Treaty, didn't give a fuck if the world devolved into another blood-sodden abattoir. He wasn't going to have the United States getting in no League of No Nations. And so that's 1919 and 1920. Imagine that. Republicans have been fucking America for at least 100 years. But eventually we figured out that World War I and all its slaughter and carnage and the waste of an entire generation of youth, well, it wasn't going to be the war to end all wars. We found that out beginning in 1939. And so somewhere thereafter, what had begun as Armistice Day was transformed into Veterans Day. and it remained on the 11th month, day of the 11th month. And so, again, if not a happy, at least a peaceful, pleasant Veterans Day to everyone in the Horn Family Community Congregation. Now, for 100 years in New York, they've been holding a parade. At first, it too was an Armistice Day parade. Later, it became a Veterans Day parade. And it has been a solemn parade. A parade of remembrance. Not just for the living who have their own memories, but to call to mind the ones who did not get an opportunity, who did not come home. People like a couple of my uncles. One uncle, one great uncle. One didn't come home from the aftermath of the Battle of the Bulge. The other didn't come home from advancing across France toward Germany in November of 1944. And so we remember them because memory is eternity. But in New York, well, fresh off of jinxing the University of Alabama, Nitwit Nero, who recently has declared himself to be a Florida man, returned to Gotham, where he fucked up their Veterans Day commemoration. He spoke at the beginning, I suppose, in Madison Square Park. And in order to protect him from being booed and treated in the something less than welcoming fashion that most New Yorkers wanted to treat Chlamydia Claudius, the city of New York built or arranged, not so much built, arranged a wall of garbage trucks around Madison Square Park, so that no one could treat him in the fashion he, a draft-dodging coward, so richly deserves. In a couple of the videos that I watched, you could hear him droning away in the background. The traitor. The treasonous president. The draft-dodger. Coward. And many veterans there were furious that he was there too. What right did he have to be there? He wasn't a veteran. Traditionally, the job of the President of the United States on this day is to go to our version of what the British refer to as the cenotaph, the tomb of the unknown, which is exactly what we don't call it cenotaph here. It is simply the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery across the river from the nation's capital. There on the old Robert E. Lee slave plantation, where perpetual guard is kept over that memorial to the unknown fallen of our wars. Generally speaking, it is the president's job to go and lay a wreath there, because it is more than appropriate for a president to do that. Not all presidents are veterans. Not all presidents are veterans of wars. In time of war, according to the Constitution, the President of the United States becomes Commander-in-Chief. He is not commander-in-chief 24/7, no matter what the millionaires in the for-profit media keep prattling on about. But there he was in New York, defaming a 100-year-old tradition with his yellow-bellied presence. So, as Willie Loman's wife says at the end of Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. Ron and Raleigh with a note. They call Alabama the Crimson Tide. They call me Deacon Blues. The man is a pox on all he touches. I don't know how this fucking coward, Mike Pence as well, could preside over Veterans Day ceremonies. Draft-dodging shitheel talking about sacrifice and honor. Fuck him. And also from the ad hoc corrections department. No, not like prisons, but we're talking about editorial corrections. Not to be nitpicking on nitwit Nero's affairs, Bob, says Brother Deacon Asa, but isn't melanoma third lady where Trump is concerned? Or perhaps 29th lady if you count all the porn stars? Ooh, I don't think there's... I think we're still waiting for the highfalutin ivory tower geniuses to come up with the math we need to calculate that kind of number. So we got that going for us. In terms of news, I think we found out today why it is that the that people like Matt Serial DUI Getz and Louis Asparagus Gohmert and Steve Cantaloupe's King and various and Kevin McCarthy and various and sundry white wing weirdos threw a fit on that particular day at the SCIF when Laura Cooper was set to testify. I'm sorry, I'm a person of a certain age, so I keep thinking, wasn't that the name of a character on Twin Peaks? Well, anyway, this Laura Cooper is a real human being, and she happens to be the Pentagon official, the highest-ranking Pentagon official, who was in charge of overseeing the United States' relationship with Ukraine. You might recall that Laura Cooper was all set to testify on October the 23rd when all of a sudden people like Mo Brooks, Les Brames invaded the room and proceeded to order pizza and use their cell phones inside a secure, clean room dedicated to stuff that didn't need to be anywhere near electronic transmissions. Well, there was a reason Laura Cooper made them particularly nervous, because Laura Cooper straight up dropped the dime on Julius Geezer. Ah, there we go. Okay, that squares it up. Thank you. Steve in New York, serving as the ad hoc Horn Research Department. It was Laura Palmer, Agent Cooper. It's been a while. So, thank you. That'll help my brain a little bit. She had to flee when the Republicans rioted. But still, they did take Laura Cooper's testimony, her sworn testimony, her sworn oath attested deposition. And lo and behold, she had something to say, because the transcript of her testimony has been released. triggering, of course, another freak out by Geezer Disgustus to the extent that Shifty Shiv is releasing fake transcripts. No, he's not. Because the people making the transcripts do that for their living, and they have to sign off on their own oath that could put them in prison, or at least prevent them from ever doing that job again, if they were to dummy up a transcript. And these depositions, of course, are real transcripts. They're not. They don't have, for instance, like the memorandum of the Ukraine call does, something in bold-faced lettering across the top that says, "Not a transcript." No, this is an actual transcription of the words that Laura Cooper spoke in answering questions and making a statement. And this one stings. Because she goes all the way back to the middle of June. Yeah, maybe even before the summer solstice, when the summer held so much promise and so much warmth and light. And so it was the middle of June when she and other folks from the Pentagon had fielded questions about the Ukraine assistance. And then a month or so passes, or a few weeks at least, and one of her subordinates comes up and says, "Hey, they've put a hold on the Ukraine funds." And this is after the subordinate had been to an interagency meeting. Well, in her testimony, Laura Cooper said, I got a readout from the meeting. There was discussion in that session about Office of Management and Budget saying that they were holding the congressional notification related to Ukraine. And she said it was unusual, and in point of fact, she was probably flabbergasted. So then she herself shows up at a meeting on July the 23rd, where one of the maggots tried to say, "Well, you know, the president has concerns about Ukraine and Ukraine security assistance." And the maggot who brought that up was none other than Mick Mulvaney. 3 days later, she found out that both the military and the humanitarian aid had been locked down. And she said she and others immediately became concerned because, there were questions as to whether the President of the United States had the power to stop aid from flowing that had already been appropriated by Congress. She said there were concerns about how this could be done in a legal fashion because there was broad understanding in the meeting that the funding, the State Department funding, related to an earmark for Ukraine, and the DOD funding was specific to Ukraine security assistance, so the comments in the room at the deputies' level reflected a sense that there was not an understanding of how this could legally play out, and at that meeting, the deputies agreed to look into legalities and look at what was possible. They then come back and she describes that they felt like they had identified two legally available mechanisms should the president want to stop assistance. Either a presidential rescission notice to Congress or a reprogramming action via the Defense Department. There was only one problem. In either instance, Laura Cooper pointed out that they would have to tell Congress what they were doing. And that's the one thing that Nitwit Nero did not want to have happen. And then Cooper dropped the dime. Trump, through the Office of Management and Budget, directed the freeze on hundreds of millions of dollars of critical military aid for Ukraine against the judgment of career officials in the DOD and the Department of State and other relevant agencies. She also continued to voice her concerns about the illegality of the action. So to be clear, and, you know, okay, so he's already admitted it, too, in front of TV cameras that were able to record it for posterity. But she makes it clear that it was his decision. He was the one driving the bus. And that, in the words of Uncle Joe, is a big fucking deal. And so, beginning this week, well, venereal Vespasian has been on a full-on hissy. On Twitter and other places, it's about to get even worse. Because when the public testimony starts, well, Katie bar the door. And by the way, going back to the Veterans Day parade today in New York. Well, the demonstrators were there, and they did have something to say. A couple of guys in fatigues with big red noses were holding a sign called Operation Bone Spur. Yeah, the Boo Birds were there, and the Lock Him Up people were there, and I'm sure some of the easily disturbed multimillionaires from the for-profit media were terribly upset by that. Yeah, and his actions, he's trying to brazen it out. He's trying to pile one impeachable offense on another. The anonymous book that is getting so much press of late, A Warning, which really, it's hard to feel much sympathy or respect for the author. But there are little titbits in there. Among other things, the claim that one National Security Agency head went to Trump to talk about how to get Congress to appropriate necessary funds for that office. To which he replied, "Don't worry about Congress, just do what you need to do." At which point the official had to explain that, "Well, no, we don't get to print our own money over here. We can only spend money that Congress gives us to spend." And Nitwit Nero replied, No, it doesn't matter. You have my permission to do whatever you need to do, okay? Just forget about them." No kidding. Then there's Mick Mulvaney. Who tried to bogart in on John Bolton's lawsuit. Bolton has asked a federal court to weigh in on whether or not he, Bolton, should respond to a subpoena issued by Congress, even though executive privilege has been claimed by Carotene Caligula. And while, from a rule of law standpoint, you've got a subpoena, you honor the goddamn subpoena. But they've raised a conflict there, so it's not entirely bullshit for Bolton to make that request of the court. Now, the court has to have jurisdiction. The court cannot issue advisory opinions, which this sounds like. But on top of it all, Mick Mulvaney ran in and said, yeah, me too. You know, he's South Carolina boy. And Bolton's people said, get off my lawsuit, you fucker. Because Mulvaney has already received the subpoena and refused the subpoena and cannot be heard now to go in front of a court and say, well, why don't you tell me if I can? Because he's already flaunted the law. And so we're finding out now why at least some components of the aid were held up. And that comes from the Ukraine Special Advisor Catherine Croft's testimony to the House. And she told them that Mick Mulvaney himself, with no legal justification whatsoever, put a hold on what are called javelin missiles being sent to Ukraine. Because, again, they wanted to strong-arm Ukraine into digging up dirt and somehow justifying a completely fantastic theory of Ukrainian involvement in the 2016 election. But the other part of it is, Mulvaney was skeert. That's how we pronounce it here, skeert. Mulvaney was skeert that Mother Russia would be upset. Catherine Croft's testimony includes this statement. In a briefing with Mr. Mulvaney, the question centered around the Russian reaction. Mulvaney feared that Russia would react negatively to the provision of javelins to Ukraine. Well, since when do we much give a fuck? I mean, there's, sure, the Cuban Missile Crisis, nukes in Turkey, nukes in Cuba, blah, blah, blah. But we have a treaty relationship with Ukraine. We have an ongoing support relationship with Ukraine, who were, of course, invaded by Mother Russia and harmless, lovable, snuggleable, cuddleable pooty-poot. But Russia has never had veto power over whom we can and cannot arm. I mean, if that was the case, then old Ronald Wilson Reagan, old 666 himself, bromance with the Mujahideen, would have been scotched from jump. So we have to ask the question, what were we afraid of Russia doing if they became upset that we sent javelin missiles to Ukraine? Reckon old Matt, Mick, might have had a chit-chat with Nitwit Nero? All about how we couldn't upset Pooty Poot because, well, somebody might let slip something about something that happened in a hotel room either in Moscow or St. Petersburg, long about the time of, the Miss Universe pageant a few years back. I mean, it's worth at least thinking about. And meanwhile, the aid to Kurt Volker, again, Catherine Croft, went on to tell Congress that the Ukrainians, their leadership, found out that he had decided to twist their arm and shake them down a long time before the withholding of the legally appropriated aid became public knowledge. In Croft's testimony, she said that her Ukrainian opposites, quote, approached me quietly and in confidence to ask me about an Office of Management and Budget hold on Ukraine security assistance. And she said she was shocked how quickly they became aware of it. Well, they became aware of it so quickly because they had to be aware of it in order for them to be shaken down. I mean, you can't shake somebody down without at least saying to them, nice house you got there, be a pity if something happened to it. So like I said, the walls are closing in and Nitwit Nero is beginning to sweat. And nobody out there believes what Nitwit Nero said about rooting out corruption because, well, frankly, it doesn't hold water. And again, this goes back to Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson, both of whom worked for Ambassador Kurt Volker. In a joint statement, the three chairs of the three committees doing the investigation said Ms. Croft also testified that Ukrainian officials approached her quietly, like we were just talking about. And then a quote from the transcript, and I think you testified earlier that you drew a distinction between anti-corruption efforts and specific investigations. This is to Mr. Anderson. Correct. Correct. Was the answer. Christopher Anderson. And you felt like anti-corruption efforts writ large were part of U.S. official policy, correct? Anderson replies, it was our policy to push. We have specific deliverables on anti-corruption that we had developed. Individual investigations were not part of that policy that I was aware of. Oops. It is all falling apart. Note coming from James in Illinois. Rick Steves travel as political statement. I found myself watching PBS last night, and Rick Steves was in Italy talking with a couple of historians about the rise of fascism. He touched on Hitler, giving a brief synopsis on the rise of Hitler, then started talking about our own time, showing a few photos of the current crop of idiots in Europe. Then he said a few words about how we must remain vigilant because it could happen here. Everyone there knew he was talking about the moron, but Steves is probably just not wanting to give Republicans any reason to harm the network any more than they already have. Sure, everybody knows. Absolutely everybody knows. Ugly day today in Poland with a memorial to the uprising there being co-opted by the Polish right wing, the same assholes who brought American Confederate flags to a Polish rally with Trump a couple of years back, you'll recall. They were forbidden from bringing swastika flags. So recognizing that the Confederate flag and the swastika are basically the same idea, they flew Confederate flags at their Trump rally instead. Well, it was right nasty in Warsaw today. Nasty in Hungary with Viktor Orban. Fascism is on the march. And it's largely out of the bottle in a big way thanks to Nitwit Nero. Of course, the other thing that happened over the weekend was the usual Sunday shows. But I have, and I've been talking about it quite a bit here on this program. I think, well, far be it from me to be a constitutional originalist, but I think when we talk about impeachment, we need to use the language the framers gave us instead of confusing Emory and Marvelline there in their matching Barca loungers down at the Ballerina Swan Lake trailer court and country club with fancy words like quid pro for tat or tit pro quid or anything like that. Fact is, the maggots would probably understand tit for tat more easily, but far too many of them would be made entirely unhinged and sexually wrought by the mention of the word tit. Can't say that on TV in America, of course, you know. I mean, just from an art of word-knowing perspective, over in merry old England, when you have a little morsel of something, it's a tit bit. But because we're a bunch of hung-up puritanical freaks here in Merca, it was changed to tid bit. Now, I'm just guessing at this, but you know, there's a little teeny tiny bird out there called a titmouse. And so a bit fit for a titmouse, well, it's tiny indeed, isn't it? But over here, we titter when we say titmouse. And we certainly aren't going to say titbit or tit for tat. Because, well, propriety and decency. Sure. I was talking to Dr. Bill earlier today because we didn't get to, well, we were, Ferg was having oral surgery today. And so the day started very early and we knew there was no way we were going to get home in time to have Dr. Bill on air. So I called him to let him know. He'll be on air tomorrow. It should be the usual, or perhaps better than usual, program. Because I asked him, because he's so very good at this sort of thing. He knows the history of the ratification of the Constitution better than some people know how to get from their bedroom to their bathroom. And so I asked him, I said, Dr. Bill, what was the understanding of the framers in regard to bribery when it says in the Constitution that a president can be impeached for treason, bribery, or high crimes or misdemeanors? And he said, well, Bob, I hadn't really thought about it. I said, would you please? Because it matters. One of the lines of defense of these un-American freaks who favor dictatorship as long as it's a Republican dictator, one of the things they're going to do is they're going to try to confuse the issue by confusing a very easily confusable American public. Because we are very poorly civically edumacated. And so people have begun moving away from quid pro quo and now they're talking, you're hearing the word extortion. But that's still too big a word. Extortion. The Constitution gives us the tools with which to describe impeachment. Treason, bribery, or high crimes or misdemeanors. And the problem with that high crimes or misdemeanors thing is that it is kind of nebulous. I mean, as we found out in the late 90s, high crimes or misdemeanors can mean any blowjob that a Democrat got that a Republican didn't. But in terms of, well, and we've already heard it, Precious Lindsay saying, well, my goodness gracious, their Ukraine policy was incoherent. They were too stupid to be able to form the intent to commit a high crime or a misdemeanor. My goodness, oh, mercy sakes. Somebody get me a Darvon and a Brandy Alexander, or perhaps a grasshopper. Bribery, though, most people understand. But even that becomes a bit complicated because we have bribery statutes now. And not only do we have bribery statutes, we have the words in Citizens United of that former justice of the Supreme Court whose son just happened to be the private banker for Donald Trump over at Ye Olde Deutsche Bank. It's in Citizens United where, and I'm paraphrasing, Justice Anthony Kennedy says, hey, just because somebody has a thing they want done and they give money to a politician and the politician then does the thing that the guy with the money wanted done does not mean bribery. Holy fuck. So that's a problem. But it's only a problem for so long as you stay hung up in language other than that which was used by the framers. So like I was saying, if but for a moment or two, I am an originalist. In other words, if we want to know about bribery, and of course, Republican constitutional originalism is the kind of originalism that says, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson got to rape his slaves, so slave raping should be allowed today. 'Cause originalism. I mean, the fat dead Tony Scalia kind of originalism, the three-fifths clause would still be a going concern in our politics. But the originalism that I'm looking for is the originalism that says actually trying to discern the intent of the framers where that intent is clear and unambiguous is a good idea. So the Constitution gets ratified in 1787. And they use the words treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. Both Dr. Bill and I have in the past, with capable assistance, say, from our buddy Steve in New York, pointed out that high crimes or misdemeanors is a term of art, which is to say it's a legal concept that doesn't necessarily mean what people think it means, that it had specific meaning to the people who wrote the Constitution. So too with bribery. And as with almost everything in the Constitution, it is carried over from the common law of Merry Old England. And the common law is a fairly unique Anglo concept. that a law that a law would be developed through practice and procedure and decisions that would be common to all, and not a function of some sort of Byzantine, literally Byzantine code based on the Code of Justinian, which, oddly enough, from the 12 tables to the Code of Justinian, most other European law, including the Napoleonic Code, which comes down to us this day in portions of the law of the state of Louisiana, derives. No, England said they were going to do it a different way. And so early on, they started talking about and writing about what things meant in the law. And so in 1716, you get a guy, a lawyer, by the name of William Hawkins in England, who wrote A Treatise of the Pleas of the Crown. And lo and behold, he wrote about bribery. And William Hawkins, speaking of bribery, said, "Bribery, in a large sense, is sometimes taken for the receiving or offering," underline that, offering, get your highlighter out, doop, yellow, "offering of any undue reward by or to any person whatsoever whose ordinary profession or business relates to the administration of public justice in order to incline him to do a thing against the known rules of honesty and integrity." We can underline and highlight known rules of honesty and integrity while we're going. "For the law abhors any the least tendency to corruption in those who are any way concerned in its administration, and will not endure their taking a reward for the doing a thing which deserves the severest of punishments." So apparently, if we could conjure up zombie William Hawkins from 1716 and give him the fact pattern where a presiding executive withholds legally given money on the demand that another party do a thing against the known rules of honesty and integrity, that is, dig up phony baloney, not even real dirt, on the political opponent who is scaring the said executive right out of his depends. Well, I think zombie William Hawkins would have to say, "Yeah, that's what I meant by bribery, all right." At which point, Washington and Madison and Hamilton and John Jay and Gouverneur Morris and Ben Franklin would go, "Well, that's what we meant, too." And so if that's the meaning of bribery, then in a world where Republicans were actually honest, I know, there wouldn't be able to be, it would be impossible for there to be a single dissenting vote on a bribery article of impeachment. Stunning, huh? And the framers and founders themselves had plenty to say as well. Oh, yes, indeed. And it doesn't help either. Because remember, one of the things that they were most concerned about was that a young, broke nation, weak as a kitten, would be at risk of having its government influenced by other governments. That was 1787, and we weren't even out of the 18th century before exactly that was happening with the head of the military in the western United States, General James Wilkinson, who was cashing checks, okay, accepting pouches of Spanish gold for selling out his own country. They had a reason to be worried about it. Those worries produced, among other things, the Emoluments Clause. Then there's Federalist 68. Alexander Hamilton wrote that in 1788. And he said, these most deadly adversaries of Republican government might naturally have been expected to make their approaches from more than one quarter, but chiefly from the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. How could they better gratify this than by raising a creature of their own to the chief magistracy of the Union? Oh, look, it's Mother Russia. Now, granted, the framers of the Constitution were more worried about France and England because Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin were definite Francophiles, and, well, John Adams just deeply regretted that there had to be a bust-up with dear old King George. And they all recognized the risk in each other. And so they took what steps they could to protect against it. It was, I think, 1797, just 10 years after the Constitution was ratified, that the state of Delaware passed a statute about bribery. And it's basically the same thing. See, at the time of the ratification, there was no U.S. code. There were no federal statutes passed because the Congress had not yet been empowered to do that kind of work. So they had to rely on English common law definitions. So there was no intent to make bribery adhere to some statutory scheme. And we even have an example in 1912 of a judicial impeachment, including a bribery charge. And in that instance, the House Judiciary Committee on July 8th, 1912, said, it is well established by the authorities that impeachment is not limited to statutable crimes and misdemeanors or to offenses indictable under the common law and triable in the courts of ordinary jurisdiction. And, by the way, Judge Archibald, who was the subject of the impeachment, was ultimately removed from office. And so it becomes important that we bear this stuff in mind as the discussion begins to turn more toward the specifics of what an article would be like. And so you get John Yarmouth talking on MSNBC early, I think, was it maybe yesterday morning? Who, when asked what he expected out of a bill of impeachment, said, well, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a bribery article. Telling me without a doubt that John Yarmuth damned well knows what's going on here. And of course, John Yarmuth is no slouch because he heads the budget committee. So he's up there among the more rarefied sectors of the congressional leadership. Darlene, with a note earlier, said the problem is the lamestream, including MSNBC and CNN talking heads, keep referring to impeachment as an extraordinary or extreme remedy. They're blowing it so out of proportion to make it seem like it will cause the earth to shift out of its very orbit. Let's keep it in check here. The framers gave us a vital tool to course correct and save the goddamned republic. Precisely. It's like I keep saying, impeachment isn't the Constitution failing. Impeachment is the Constitution succeeding. The fact that he has not yet been impeached is the failure. And it needs to be understood as such. Oh, and I was saying high crimes or misdemeanors. No, Steve notes, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. But high crimes and misdemeanors, if you're going to impeach on that, it doesn't mean that you've got to have a high crime and a misdemeanor, or multiple misdemeanors, or multiple high crimes. It's not conjunctive in that sense. Again, it's a term of art. Scott in San Diego, high crimes and misdemeanors. Back in the day, our powdered wig-wearing forefathers tended to write down stuff worth knowing and preserving. Somewhere, certainly, somebody jotted down a few cogent notes listing what were considered to be low crimes and maybe even high crimes. If such writings do exist, it might be helpful to find those papers to see what they can tell us. No, you're not going to find a definition of low crimes versus high crimes. High crimes and misdemeanors is again, a term of art. It doesn't mean multiple things. High crimes and misdemeanors doesn't mean felonies and misdemeanors. Misdemeanor means bad behavior, which is another way of saying corruption in office. There are no low crimes. I mean, a low crime is a misdemeanor within criminal law perspective. But this doesn't have anything to do with the criminal law. This has to do with corrupt behavior in office and a violation of the public trust. Let me check here on something. Stand by. I just wanted to see if I had the John Yarmuth clip. I thought I saved it, but I can't be for sure. Nope, I guess not. Well, it's not that critical in the grand scheme of things. On the other hand, however, you have Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut. And he showed up on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. And Jim Himes' appearance followed in the wake of an appearance by that leading light of constitutional scholarship. And I'm talking about libertarian ophthalmologist and worshiper of Aqua Buddha, Rand Paul, and that thing on his head. Who, of course, with no challenge whatsoever from Joke Toad, Chuck Todd, rambled out some genuine 200-proof libertarian gibberish.
Here that might make you... Are you an open-minded juror? Let me ask it that way.
I'm very open-minded and fair-minded. You'll not meet a person who is more fair than I am. I really do believe that justice should be colorblind, genderblind, you name it. I think justice should. But, you know, one of our traditions about justice, about finding justice, is a defense should be able to present their witnesses. So,
time out. When he says that he believes justice should be colorblind, genderblind, what have you, remember, this is a guy who told Rachel Maddow some several years ago now that he would have voted against the Civil Rights Act because the free market would have eventually solved the problem of Jim Crow. So that's what he means when it should be gender blind and color blind. He just wants that, among other things, that means he doesn't want the judicial system to recognize that racism and sexism even exist. And even if it were to notice that, he certainly doesn't want it to be actionable. Just making things clear. Don't worry, I'm not going to disappoint you, Darlene. Darlene in Connecticut says, oh, don't disappoint me. Jim Himes is a good guy. He is a good guy. I agree. And he was particularly good in this clip. So the question, because it's a fair question, how much should members of the Senate be saying about the impeachment process? What happens to you as a juror if upon voir dire you look to the judge and say, well, I think this whole process stinks. I don't know why the defendant wasn't allowed in his lawyer to present evidence to the grand jury just like the prosecutor done. Don't seem fair to me. Goodbye, juror. Even though that's not how the process works. Never has. That juror would be excused and not allowed to sit in judgment in the trial. Well, Precious Lindsey Graham is a member of the jury panel if a bill of impeachment goes over, and he's already said, I ain't going to have nothing to do with it. I can't worry about it. I'll worry about it tomorrow. Right now I have to worry about the barbecue down to 12 Oaks and Ashley. And you got various and sundry Republican senators out there running their mouths. And Rand Paul, oh, I'm going to be fair, but they're not being fair. It's not I ain't being fair. It's they not being fair.
Should be colorblind, genderblind, you name it. I think justice should. But, you know, one of our traditions about justice, about finding justice, is a defense should be able to present their witnesses. So if you can't call Hunter Biden and you can't call the whistleblower, that's sort of a sham. That's not even really a trial.
No, well, that's because it's not a trial, Rand, you fucking idiot. Jesus Christ, how much did your racist old daddy have to give him down there to actually let you into medical school to become an ophthalmologist? The trial is in the Senate, stupid. That's in the Constitution, you prate so much that you cherish. He's not on trial in the House, you goddamn fool. And then no prosecutor is required to bring in defense witnesses or Hunter Biden before the grand jury. God damn. But again, we're up against the fact or the problem that Joke Toad is not going to challenge any of this bullshit. Not to any meaningful degree. And Rand Paul's not going to smarten up a chump. And so Mr. and Mrs. America and Mr. and Mr. America and Mrs. America are just going to have to sit out there and figure it out for themselves. And they, by God, don't have that many ways of doing that.
So I am fair-minded, but the trial has to be fair.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, thank you.
See what I mean? Joke Toad just let Rand Paul rest his scrotum on his fuzzy little beard and then leave. I gotta at least hope that Joke Toad knows that an impeachment proceeding in the House is not a trial. He could have told him that, but no, he just lets him lie and get away with it. It's the ancient dishonorable tradition of Meet the Press that goes back from Joke Toad through Disco Dave, MC Rove Gregory, and all the way back to when Tim Russert was letting Dick Cheney rest his shriveled old testicles on his chin. They suck.
For coming on and sharing your views, sir. I much appreciate it.
Now, Jim Himes is about to show up. Let's find out how Joke Toad treats him.
Thank you.
And joining me now from Stamford, Connecticut, is Democratic Congressman Jim Himes, who sits on the Intelligence Committee. Congressman Himes, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Good morning, Chuck.
Let me start with this. Will there be new information the public learns from these public hearings on Wednesday morning?
There will be new information. I suspect most of the public has not read the release transcripts. And what they're going to hear is they are going to hear immensely patriotic, beautifully articulated, articulate people telling the story of a president who, let's forget quid pro quo. Quid pro quo is one of these things to muddy the works.
Yay, Jim Himes. Yay. Forget quid pro quo. I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now, and it's almost, well, yeah. Hi, Jim.
Who extorted a vulnerable country by holding up military aid. So, yes, they are going to hear something new. And, Chuck, if you'll grant me 1 second here.
That's good. So he used the word extortion. What I'm imploring him to do is to maybe have a chat with his colleague, John Yarmuth, and start using, and all of us, quit telling us which words to use, Bob. All of us, start using the constitutional language. Say bribery. Say it out loud. Say it on social media. He needs to be impeached for bribery because bribery is in the Constitution and it fits what he did. Bribery is not limited to the acceptance of the bribe, but is also inclusive of the offer of the bribe. This is reasonably important. Okay, it's very important. But now here's the part where Jim Himes gets a gold star for his Meet the Press performance. I was so proud of him because he had his little IFB thingy in his ear. And maybe he was even able to watch it on the TV box because he knows what Randy Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist who's comfortably well off, socially secure, and that thing on his head, done just said.
My head is only now decombusting from the exchange you had with Rand Paul. I've spent 11 years in public service defending the press. And when Senator Rand Paul comes on and says that what Donald Trump did, and the transcript is there, extorting a foreign government for his personal political gain, and that's exactly the same thing as Joe Biden, exactly the same thing as what he said, as Joe Biden saying that this prosecutor should be released, when Joe Biden is acting in consistency with American foreign policy, and back then we had a whole list of things that had to be done, and this was American foreign policy, it was European Union policy, it was IMF policy, that this prosecutor needed to go. When Rand Paul says that that's exactly the same thing as the President of the United States saying, you need to find dirt on my political opponent, and with all due respect, Chuck, when you say, well, do two wrongs make a right, let's be very clear. The President of the United States demanding, extorting a vulnerable country to do his political bidding, to go after his opponent, has nothing to do with Joe Biden executing the foreign policy of the United States or Hillary Clinton, who is a private citizen, doing opposition research on her presidential opponent. Those are radically different things, and what the president did is wrong and impeachable.
Let me ask you something. You just said...
Yeah, we're good. Moving right along now, being as how you just tacked my ass up on the wall and showed me up for the fluffing softball lobbing POS that I am. Let's go to another question. Busted, joke Toad. Busted. And so, no, I told you, Darlene, I wasn't going to disappoint you. I'm proud of him. I kind of wish it hadn't taken as long as it did. Because when he said, I've spent 11 years defending a free press, I think maybe what was churning in the gears up there was, and you are a disgrace to what I have defended. Because Joke Toad is a disgrace. He's not a journalist. He's an accessist. He sits there with a camera pointed at him and asks easy questions of Republicans who are not capable of answering anything else, and then nods and gives them a last little fluff and sends them on their way like he did with Rand Paul. In a way, while I said on the one hand I thought the answer was a little too lengthy, in another way, I wish it had been longer, because it would have been nice, because obviously Joke Toad has no idea how impeachment works, if Jim Himes could have given him a little bit of a primer on that as well, noting what I did a few minutes ago, that what's happening in the House is not a goddamn trial, and they're not allowed to put Hunter Biden on the stand in an effort to smear him and smear the Biden campaign, which, incidentally, I wish would just go away. Lest anybody think that I'm some sort of Uncle Joe fan at this point. If he's the nominee, I'll vote for him. I don't have a problem saying that. Ooh. And today, while we were out, we were coming back from the oral surgeons. Behold the coelacanth. I've done found him. I've found the Joe Biden supporter. Yes. West Virginia plate. Don't know who this person was. I think it was a Subaru Outback. But there, a square on the back of his vehicle, that logo, red, white, blue, Joe 2020, or Joe 20. I have found the ever-elusive Biden fan. Yes. Now, in West Virginia, we got a Republican problem. But you see Warren stickers. You see Bernie stickers. There are people who haven't taken their Bernie stickers off since 2016. But that is the first Biden sticker that I have seen. Now, I'm told, I've never really found them, that somewhere out there, there are more Biden supporters. I read another one of those ubiquitous articles about South Carolina and about how all the older African Americans are for Joe, and how Joe says, well, gosh darn it, I'm the only one who can bring us all together under our big tent where we can listen to the Victrola together. Discuss our favorite kinds of pomade. And I can tell stories of corn pop. That's unfair of me. That's unfair. I apologize. Because, God, he may wind up being the last hope we have of removing Donald Trump from office as of January 20th, 2021. Yeah, holy shit, right? But the article I read was all about how other candidates are trying to chip away at Biden's firewall with those old African Americans in South Carolina stand. My aching back. But anyway, good on Jim Himes. I was proud of him. And he usually does a pretty good job on the TV. And by the way, we're at we're at about 30 minutes left in the program. And like I said, it's going to be a tough week. We're at $350 a night, and we're at zero tonight. Sorry. But we're at $350 a night for tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday, so that we're not in some giant, godforsaken, terrifying hole come next Monday. Darlene adding, right on, Jim. And Jim Himes is a true public servant because he serves on the Intelligence Committee. Serving on such a committee doesn't necessarily win you easy votes with your constituents. Intelligence isn't viewed by constituents as having a direct bearing on their lives, like the Education Committee, etc., or the Agriculture Committee, which dry drunk Matt Gaetz derided by saying, I need to be in that hearing there in the skiff. It's not like I'm on the Agriculture Committee. I really hope there's enough of a Democratic organization in Florida that they can make him wear that like a dirty toilet seat around his fucking neck. Because I can't help but guess that the Agriculture Committee's kind of important to all those Florida cattlemen and Florida grapefruit growers and citrus growers and sugar caners and whatnot. Flavio, if Biden is nominated, I think you know what will happen. It's true that no matter what candidate is nominated, the Republicans will smear as a socialist, etc., but if Biden is nominated, Flavio says, and I guess we'll say predicts, mark this on your calendar, the 11th day of the 11th month of 2019, Flavio says that if Biden's the nominee, Trump will be reelected. Subject line, Jiu-Jitsu. Oh, wait a minute, that was clever. I can't help, James in Illinois says, I can't help but thinking that the Don is trying not to defend himself against Biden, but to push us into saying, by God, leave Joe alone. I want Bernie, but now I'm a-voting for Joe, because fuck you. He would not, that's not entirely outside the realm of possibility, James. This is all through the looking glass. We are all involuntary attendees and guests at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party at this point in time. And instead of pledging allegiance, the party begins with a rousing singing of Jabberwocky. Now, I conceived this segment as, and this is not a sexual or sexist reference, but is rather a use of a term mostly meant for someone who is an idiot. This Moran Monday nomination, I began conceiving and referring to as I thought about how the program would shape up as a tale of two boobs. The title has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the two boobs in question are both Republican women. They are exemplars. Maybe I should save this for Titanic Tuesday, but I don't think it can wait. One could be held over to prayer meeting Wednesday. But I think Moran Monday is where it belongs. And by the way, going back to what Flavio said, Donald Trump better than Biden? David in South Carolina stands as Dems would rather have Donald Trump than Biden? That's sad. Oh, I don't think anybody's saying that, David. It's just that there's a creeping sense that Biden will do what Biden has always done so very, very well, and that is fuck up presidential campaigns. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anybody that wants Trump over Biden that has, you know, two brain cells to rub together. Oh, hell no. And hey, thank you very kindly to Anatole for jumping in. So we're down to 340 this evening. Thank you, Anatole. No, I call this a tale of two boobs, and the fact that it happens to be about two women is not in the least a reference to any physical attribute. It is a reference to the fact that they are two Republican women who are so goddamn dumb that it takes one's breath away to contemplate. Any guesses about who the two boobs are? Well, here's the giveaway. One of them is Nimrata Haley, formerly governor of South Carolina, the woman who, when she was ambassador to the United Nations, got herself embarrassed by a pair of morning zoo crew DJs from Moscow 97.7. The Volga Boatman. You remember, just as they did with Precious Lindsay, the morning zoo crew, Ivan and Dmitry in the morning, they called Nimrata and said that they were, well, the one who was talking said he was the president of Poland. And Nimrata, because she's a fucking idiot, believed them and went on yakety-yakking with them for a long time, up to and including her promise to look into the conflict with the island nation of Binomo. You know, Mo, Binomo. Be no mo. Them boys at Moscow 97.5 understand a little bit of American dialect, especially South Carolina style. Be no mo. And she said, yes, we're worried about that conflict. And so now, trying to position herself to gently elbow Mike Pencil Neck Geek out of the way in case he becomes a political liability to Nitwit Nero because he's up to his helmet hair in the Ukraine business. And because he's the one who did so much of the behind-the-scenes bullshit at the Republican National Convention, swanning around with Sergei Kislyak and whatnot, along with Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions the Third. Well, even though God keeps telling him he's supposed to be president, there's a possibility he may become, and there's a faction inside the Nitwit Nero regime that would like to say goodbye to super Christian Mike Pencil Neck Geek. And rumor is that they'd like to replace him with Nimrata Numbnuts Haley. That's why Nimrata Numbnuts Haley has written a new book. And by written a book, I mean she sat there and blabbed to a professional ghostwriter who then strung words together and turned it into something that they'll give away for free on campaign pitches and fundraising pitches. I forget the name of the book. I think it's With All Due Respect or some such silly shit as that. And she said that Rex Tillerson and that General John Kelly were all the time trying to subvert the president from making America great again. And I told him I wasn't having nothing to do with it. Nothing. It's pathetic. And she said, well, they shouldn't have done that. If they didn't like that, like what he was doing, they should have quit. Which sort of tells you that nobody ever told Nimrata about the 25th Amendment or Section 4 thereof. It's right frightening. And she's gone on because she's out there running her mouth. Somebody asked her about what she thought about, this was on CBS Sunday morning, about what she thought about the send her back chant relative to Ilhan Omar. Get the hockey puck.
And more than that, I think the biggest thing that bothers me is the American people should decide this. Why do we have a bunch of people in Congress making this decision?
Because impeachment is there when you've got a president who is entirely corrupt, who is selling out his own country for his own personal benefit. That's why, Nikki, which isn't really your name. That's why. But she doesn't know about that whole Constitution thingy.
Haley, herself the daughter of immigrants, also defends President Trump on one of his most inflammatory statements.
He tweeted this past summer telling the four Democratic female members of Congress, three of whom were born here in the United States, to, quote, go back and fix the crime-infested places from which they came. Was that appropriate?
No, it's not appropriate, but I also can appreciate where he was coming from from the standpoint of don't bash America over and over and over again and not do something to try and fix it.
Can you run for governor again?
Yeah.
She don't approve. She doesn't approve of telling him to go back where they come from. even though where they come from is Michigan and Massachusetts, and that Queens place, and Africa. But she sure does understand why he's bigoted like he is, because they were saying mean things about Merkel. And you don't get to say mean things about Merkel, which is hilarious coming from a South Carolinian. I mean, we do kind of know what happened in, you know, South Carolina, 1861. Yep. Had to burn the whole place down just to burn some sense into them. And not just then, you know, John C. Calhoun hollering about how the state's rights gave them the ability to override anything the federal government did that they didn't like. Oh, God. Yeah, I know. Oh, she wants to be vice president, and then she wants to be America's first woman president. But she's going to have to deal with precious Iwanka, my daddy Trump, first. Maybe Iwanka ain't such a fan anymore. But she said she stopped because she wouldn't have nothing to do with that there Rex Tillerson telling her what to do and thinking he could stop the president from MAGA and all over America. She also didn't think that she was a subordinate of the Secretary of State as the ambassador to the United Nations. She thought she was the equal of Rexon Tillerson. The only problem is, and this is probably why she's got the long knife out for Rex Tillerson, is that in her claim that Tillerson and Kelly tried to recruit her to help save the country, and she wasn't having none of it. Well, Rexon, who has not said a lot since he left the government, there you are, one day you're running the biggest, most important corporation on earth, and the next day you're getting fired by a guy who sells meat through the mail. Granted, John Goodman said that, but if Rex Tillerson ever heard that, you know he's probably gotten it tattooed on some part of the body not frequently seen by anyone but his loved ones. No, he wouldn't have any of it. Today, he put on his darkest welding glasses Ray-Bans and threw some serious shade Nimrata's way, saying, "Ambassador Haley was rarely a participant in my many meetings and is not in a position to know what I may or may not have said to the president." This, because, and of course, as far back as 2017, one White House official said, "Rex hates her. He fucking hates her." Well, how are you supposed to like somebody who's so fucking stupid that the Moscow Morning Zoo crew convinces her that a nation that doesn't exist is real and might be on the brink of war? How in heaven's name did she not just get pilloried for that stupidity? But we can ask the same about, precious Lindsay. So, you know, but folks are calling Maggie Haberman there, the chief Trump stenographer at the New York Times. And she went to Twitter and said, "I've gotten calls from three administration officials taking issue with Haley's description of herself as both stalwart defender of Trump and concerned aide. One described her as scarce during her tenure." Yeah, well, she wanted to be close enough to say that she was a loyal maggot, but far enough away not to get any of the Trump on her. Or maybe out of arm's reach so as not to be grabbed by, not so Trump wouldn't grab her by the Nimrata. Haberman went on to say that White House officials at her sources said that Nimrata was only around for the photo ops. Yeah. Wow. But remember, this is a tale of two boobs. Boob number two. And hey, thank you very kindly, Barry. Thanks for jumping in and taking us down to 290 for the evening. It all helps, especially on a tough week like this. Thank you so much, Barry. Thank you. Darlene says, most tellingly, Nikki's ghostwriter wrote that Tillerson and Kelly told her all this in confidence, and yet she ratted them out without a second thought. Funny how that works. Boob can't be trusted. Wait a minute. That's a cowbell for Darlene in Connecticut. Boob can't be trusted. That's right, Jim. Bonomo. Listed on the same peninsula as Haley's pseudo-country. There we go. Jesus, these people. Just amazing sometimes. Boob number two. This would, of course, be, and how could it not be, Tennessee's junior senator, Marsha, goodness, Blackburn. You know what's terrifying? After this next round of elections in November of next year, Marsha Goodness Blackburn is going to be the senior senator from Tennessee. Burp. No kidding. And in an effort to display, because these, you know, these are all things that are done for an audience of one. Well, she took to tweeting yesterday, and Sundays being church day, well, you're good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexuals, minds turned toward thoughts of the risen Christ, you know, the Christ who says, take up thy AR-15 and follow me. And the Christ that says, come on, y'all, let's make these little children suffer. And the Christ that says, the deadbeats you have always with ye. And the Christ that says, don't pay your taxes if you don't like to. You know, that Jesus. And so there she was, tweeting away about impeachment. Now, remember, she's another one of those jurors who ought not be talking about this shit. A 3-year coordinated effort has been underway to remove Donald Trump from office. Jesus done warned us. Jesus warned us what? Jesus warned us, watch out for the lawyers. No, she did. I realize we have some unchurched folks among the Horn Family Community Congregation, so let me help here. Jesus never said shit about lawyers to the extent that Jesus said anything at all, and this wasn't entirely made up. But you can go through the Gospels with a fine-tooth comb, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and if you must, John. You're not going to find Jesus talking about lawyers. Now, he talks about not treating poor people like shit. And some of the most important lawyers in America are the people who actually represent poor people against great big homicidal, poisoning, toxic corporations. They're working on Jesus' side. Jesus warned us, watch out for the lawyers. And she was referring to that time when Jesus was looking at the disciples and said, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Interesting that she said this in responding to a lawyer by the name of Mark S. Zaid, who is the lawyer for the whistleblower. She's that stupid. You get the idea? She probably really did tweet this herself, because she was going after the lawyer who was representing the whistleblower, whomever he or she is. What we're talking about here is the second part of Henry VI by William Shakespeare. And, you know, I've seen them from time to time, people walking around with these T-shirts, or maybe it's a coffee mug or something like that. And it's and the line from Shakespeare is, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And people knowing nothing of the play and less of the role that the law plays in our country says, hell yeah! The problem is that in the second part of Henry VI, Shakespeare puts that in the mouth of someone who has a desire to become a dictator. The character's name is Dick the Butcher. In the exchange, it's between a character named Cade and the group on stage and Dick the Butcher. Cade says, be brave then, for your captain is brave and vows reformation. There shall be in England 7 halfpenny loaves sold for a penny. The 3-hooped pot shall have 10 hoops, and I will make it felony to drink small beer. All the realm shall be in common, and in Cheapside shall my palfrey go to grass. And when I am king, as king I will be, and the crowd, being smartasses, says, God save your majesty! I thank you, good people. There shall be no money. All shall eat and drink on my score, and I will apparel them all in one livery, that they may agree like brothers, and worship me, their lord. Now, this is before the arrival of Puritanism, where, by God, they did decide they'd all dress alike and worship the Lord. And they were so obnoxious that some of them got run out of England, got run to Holland, and the next thing you know, they're on a boat and they're coming over here and fucking up this continent with a bunch of religious theocracy. So Cade says, that they may agree like brothers and worship me their Lord. And that's when Dick the Butcher hollers, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And Cade chillingly responds, nay, that I mean to do. Is not this a lamentable thing, that of the skin of an innocent lamb should be made parchment, that parchment being scribbled o'er should undo a man? Some say the bee stings, but I say 'tis the bee's wax, for I did but seal once to a thing, and I was never mine own man since. How now? The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And there's Marsha Blackburn tweeting it at the one lawyer who stands between a patriot whistleblower and grim death itself. Mark Zaid had tweeted a story from The Hill. Federal judge slams Trump's attacks on judges and legal decisions he doesn't like. And Mark Zaid said, as I've always said, it will be the lawyers. And that's when Marsha Blackburn forgot that Jesus Christ wasn't William Shakespeare and said, Jesus warned us, watch out for the lawyers. Takes a special brand of stupid to do something like that. So I'm going to leave this one up in the air. Y'all can vote on it. Who's the bigger boob? Nimrata Haley? Or Marsha Kenneth Blackburn? Ah, well, yes, of course. Brother Deacon Asa pointing out, in case there's any ambiguity, let me clear that up. Lawyers, in this case, per Marsha Kenneth Blackburn, means Jews. Oh, yeah, Jim reminding us that Nimrata Haley is on the board of Boeing. That's enough to make me an Airbus guy. Flavio letting us know Nimrata Haley got trounced on by John Legend on Twitter. Former ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley compared the possible impeachment of President Donald Trump with the death penalty, and musician John Legend couldn't let her get away with it. Impeachment is like the death penalty for a public official. When you look at the transcript, there's nothing in that transcript that warrants the death penalty for a president, she told The Hill. John Legend responded, it's not the death penalty. It's firing him from the most important job in the country because he can't be trusted with it. Real people are actually sentenced to death. This is not that. You seem like a very bright person. You obviously know he's not morally or intellectually fit for office. I wish you'd admit it for the sake of the nation and your own credibility. As Flavio notes, ouch. Yeah, it's not the death penalty. Not by a long shot. Although, if impeached and removed from office, you are forever barred from holding public office again. Or perhaps that public office. I don't know. I mean, that's supposed to be how it works. Might be a couple of exceptions to the rule. Sorry about the missing first hour. I hated that, and I've still got other stuff to go into. My God, I got a bajillion tabs just from this weekend alone. Let's wrap up, though. I don't like anybody to have to sit on hold and not get to speak their piece. Let's wrap up with Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob. Help me. You always do. Help me again.
Yes?
I saw Haley's MO on the media in recent days talking about... Oh, I had a feeling she was like, wasn't there a woman in American Revolutionary history, Barbara Fricke, who fought him off with a flagpole or something?
I know you're talking about, but I don't have the name right off the tip of my tongue.
Well, the image I got in my mind that Haley's M.O. thinks of herself as some Revolutionary War lady hero, heroine, you know, just doing her utmost to defend the Republic vis-a-vis those encroachers, those usurpers surrounding Trump, you know, sometimes referred to as grown-ups. But she threw me into a literal mindfuck, making Tillerson a bad guy. I mean, he may be a bad guy. I'm still not quite over the part about not too terribly long before Trump got into office and began assembling his cabinet. Not too terribly long before that, Tillerson, as head of Exxon, managed single-handedly and hands-onedly, personally, engineered one of the biggest, if not the biggest, oil deal in the world when he did a deal with Putin on behalf of Exxon. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. That's why he got the job.
Well, this is where I'm going. If Putin is running things from over there anyway, and Trump is part of that, certainly he sent a memo or did mind control or whatever, or flipped up the queen of fucking diamonds and rang Trump's phone to say, Raymond, why don't you spend the time playing a game of solitaire, you know? And that fucking queen of diamonds or queen of hearts or wherever the hell it was in the Manchurian candidate, you know, was put into play and said, pick Rex Tillerson as your secretary of state. So if you weren't a bad guy on account of the Russian oil deal with Exxon, I think he was a bad guy in the sense that during most of his time as Secretary of State, he bent over backwards, not filling important positions in the State Department.
Yeah, he was a stone-cold loyalist at first.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, when did he change his form of badness is what I need the help with. When did he become a defender of all things good?
Well, it's when that story came out that said that he had referred to Trump as a fucking idiot.
Yeah, but there were several who've referred to him that way, just that way, as a matter of fact. Was he the first?
Yeah, but see, Nimrata has to ride him because she hated his guts to begin with, because he knew that she was an inconsequential twit and considered her a subordinate to him as Secretary of State when she thought that ambassador to the UN was an entirely freestanding affair. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Or she damn well wanted it to be.
And prior to all this, her claim to fame was being governor of South Carolina, which doesn't require much, as I recall. Wasn't Strom Thurmond governor of South Carolina at one point? And who was that governor of South Carolina back during FDR's day? I believe he was governor of South Carolina, who they wanted for the Supreme Court at one time. The powers that be wanted Roosevelt to pick him to fill a vacancy, and Roosevelt wouldn't do it because he was just a sort of an odious sort.
Well, and a racist, and probably Eleanor said, no, you don't get to do that.
Well, yeah, I'm sure she had a hand in, you know, putting the ixnay on that. I'm telling you, man, somebody in not too many years is going to write the definitive account of this episode. And I'm going to buy that fucking book and read it and underline it and highlight it with my yellow highlighter. And then I'm going to watch the HBO movie based on the book that'll come a few years after publication. And I don't know if it'll be John Heilman and Mark, I can't think of his name. They they co-host the circus on Showtime and wrote the Game Change series. But right. then that one guy fell out of favor because of some shenanigans, sexual exploits or something.
Because he's a fucking pervert. Yes.
But, you know, someone, if not them, someone is going to write the definitive account of this. And I hope that it is on bookshelves all over the fucking country. And that we not only have it on the bookshelf, but read it. And not only read it, but learn from it. So that we don't go down this path again. This has been the most... Even in my wayward youth, doing hallucinogenics, doing all that way back then did not prepare me for the bizarre, through the fucking looking glass state of things in the actual world today.
Nobody was prepared.
You know, it's...
I know.
It's like one, when I don't need to preach to you about it, one day after another, it gets, and some Republican crazy.
It's time to get the tattoo, Scott. No matter how weird yesterday was, today was weirder. No matter how weird today was, tomorrow's going to be weirder still.
Yeah, maybe. But some Republican recently was saying that the way that you tell who's telling the truth in this impeachment thing is that the ones who willingly testify are lying, and the ones who refuse to testify are telling the truth. You got that? The ones who willingly testify are lying, and the ones who refuse to testify are telling the truth. Okay? So I'm thinking, okay, they want to call the Bidens, senior and younger, all they got to do is refuse to testify. And by virtue of that test, the Bidens are telling the truth. It's just, Lewis Carroll couldn't have come up with anything. Timothy Leary.
Why do you think I made the reference to the Mad Hatter's Tea Party?
Well, yes, of course. Of course. And what was in that hookah that the caterpillar was smoking while sitting on
fentanyl.
The mushroom? Fentanyl. Well, yeah, maybe. Maybe. Whatever Trump's on, that's what the caterpillar was smoking. And all that's missing is the disappearing Cheshire. You know, and I don't mean cheese.
No, I don't know. I'm beginning to wonder if John Bolton may be the Cheshire Cat in this one.
Well, stranger things have happened. Stranger things have happened, Bob. Wasn't part of his refusal to let Mulvaney get on to that lawsuit? If you're on a lawsuit with somebody, it's a joint action.
And you've got a commonality of interest. And the thing is, well, their interests are totally divergent because Bolton has never said, fuck no, I won't testify. Mulvaney has. So if Mulvaney was in the suit with Bolton, he would be tainting Bolton's claim with his own unclean hands.
But not only that, if he were to be allowed to sign on to that action, he has access to the strategy, which is not a good thing because there are two different strategies here. You got Bolton, who maybe, like you say, will want to do the right thing or something close to it, especially if he's got a book deal all inked and ready to go.
That's why he said all this. Oh, yeah. I got some serious secret shit. Really? Will you come tell us? Well, not unless my mother will let me. But meanwhile, let me sign this $2 million book deal.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry that you didn't include the guy from Meet the Press. Not the guy from Meet the Press. Old Rand Paul. One of his other things that he talked about was, you know, on this Ukraine thing, selling, you know, giving the aid. He said, well, and another way to look at it, I don't think we should be tossing out money just that freely to anybody. You know, he wanted to make it a budgetary
right.
thing.
Well, fiscal, you know, that's because he's a theistical conservative libertarian. who's very fiscally conservative about everything but his own wallet.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there. I almost, at that moment, got out my Bible, blew the dust off it, my old red leather-bound Scofield Bible, and swore never to watch Meet the Press again. If this is the caliber of thing that is presented on the Sabbath or any other day, I don't think I want to watch it, you know? But anyway, I wanted to chime in with just those few observations. And oh my God!
Well, yeah, and we're a little over time, but I did want to get you in. But I forgot it was actually going to be a tale of three boobs.
Wait a minute, you know the difference between or what martinis and women's breasts have in common?
Don't. I have repeatedly said that this has nothing to do with anatomy.
Okay, so this is not a tit talk. The Monday edition of Tit Talk on the Horn. Okay, go ahead.
You don't stop, do you?
I'll calm down. Well, I'm distraught. Sometimes we make light of things just to mechanism.
I understand. But no, it's a tale of three boobs. Because I forgot the third boob because the two boobs were so profound.
So we're playing a little game of three boob Monty, are we?
Well, I suppose so. and once again, it's another Republican female in government. Although once upon a time she was a Fox Attack blonde. She's now the assistant. Take a breath. She is now the assistant secretary of public affairs for the U.S. Department of the Treasury. No shit. We're talking, of course, about former Fox Attack blonde Monica Crowley.
Oh, God. There's another one.
Yeah. Well, as you may have noted, over the weekend, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
a lot of good
enter,
that did us.
Enter... Monica Crowley, who back in 2015, October the 5th, 2015, while she was still just an ignorant Fox Attack blonde, well before she became an ignorant Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs for the U.S. Department of the Treasury, she had a picture taken of herself in Berlin at... a remaining little chunk of the Berlin Wall. It's there as a sort of museum piece.
Yeah, it's a tourist thing.
Yeah. And back in 2015, she tweeted, "At the Berlin Wall last week, walls work."
Oh, God.
Now, by this time, Nitwit Nero was out there running around screaming, "Build the wall, build the wall, we got to build the wall." And so she was early on trying to get her nose up there amongst the moist, brown, and smelly.
Ew.
That was back when he was hollering about how Mexico will pay for it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. At the Berlin Wall, walls work. So she was actually pitching for the Mexican border wall by celebrating the brutality represented by the Berlin Wall. Authoritarian's gonna authoritate. Oh, wait a minute. I got a cowbell for Darlene in Connecticut there. That's a two cowbell night for Darlene. You there, Scott?
Yeah, right here.
Okay. Darlene says, "Scott and his unabashed boob talk makes me wonder, is he in his cups?" Get it? LOL. cups, boobs.
Yes.
Yeah. Well played. Well played, I've Darlene.
Got,
well played.
I've got my Fredericks of Hollywood pointed.
No, no, I have, no, I, no, 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 I, no, no, no,
no. You didn't let me finish. I have it attached to the TV because it brings out, brings over, brings up, shit. It brings in, I knew it had to be a two-letter word of some sort, it brings in the over-the-air channels like you wouldn't believe, Bob.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it has a metallic thing, or the wire, the underwire.
Yes, yes.
But and I drink out better, of it when I don't have it hooked to the TV for reception.
Yeah, yeah. Better than any rabbit ears. Yes.
Yes. But, yeah, I was watching over the week, because now I have all three C-SPAN channels again. And I'm watching the NBC breaking coverage 30 years ago with Garrick Utley and Fred Francis and Tom Brokaw and who knows who else was working 30 years ago at 30 Rock, you know, with the breaking news. And I'm thinking, geez, that was quite an accomplishment. And the Cold War supposedly ended, which brought about the new, we had to have a new boogeyman or boogie person. And, you know, the people flying planes into buildings would suit that purpose just as good as any, because there's no end in sight as far as that deal. If you thought the Cold War went a good long while, the War on Terror, I'll be dead and gone years from now, hopefully, and that thing will still be going on. It's perfect for the occasion, you know. They can you know, not to do tit talk again, but boy, the government sugar tit is a big sugar tit for the military industrial congressional complex when it comes to the War on Terror. I have not yet begun to suck, says the operatives of the military industrial congressional complex with that one. But Jesus, what a world, and what a lost opportunity. Is the best Russia could do to replace one form of totalitarian rule for an economic and a plutocracy? Is that the best that the former Soviet Union could do?
Yeah, it's a different tradition. The most ancient origins of any ideas of governance in Russia come up out of the Byzantine Empire, which at the point in time, I mean, it was imperial. Okay, there was, granted, it was in roughly in an area we refer to as Greece, but it partook nothing of Athenian democracy. It modeled itself on the Senate and the SPQR concept out of Rome, the Senate and the people of Rome, but was ruled for all intents and purposes by his word is law emperor. And so that's what goes north, and it starts out in the Kingdom of Rus in Kiev and works its way to Moscow. And so that authoritarian style of rule is all they've ever known.
Now, where are Gog and Magog?
Oh, stop it. Hey, go ask Hal Lindsey.
Yeah. Well, he's just up the street. He's up in, is it Temecula? No, it's up further.
God, he's still alive.
He's not far from here. Oh, yeah. I met him when I first moved out here. I visited a church, believe it or not. And he was a featured speaker one night, and I brought along my ancient copy of Late Great Planet Earth, and he signed it for me, but I got rid of it. It was bringing bad mojo down on me. Got rid of all those religious books, except my red leather Scofield Bible. I have that still. But,
and just because it's more in Monday, and just to end on a giggle,
yeah.
Speaking of books, are you familiar with the prank that was pulled on...
Yes.
on Butthead.
Yes.
Where, yes, they changed book jackets.
Yeah. And, at a Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, and changed it to "Daddy, please love me."
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they've done it. Apparently, it's a thing now because there's one with it, there's one with Kuse on it too. It's titled "I Eat Paste."
Yeah. Yeah.
But the best part of that whole transaction is that remember the book is called Triggered.
Oh yeah.
And.
Would they run out of ends?
All right.
At the typesetting place.
Yeah. No. So he went to UCLA at the behest of Turning Point USA. You know, that little proto-fascist college Republican outfit, the one I was talking about. I guess Thursday night. Well, he got heckled out of the room. He did. But it wasn't the mean liberals who heckled him out of the room.
Yeah.
It was maggots. He got run out of UCLA by a bunch of MAGA because he showed up there with his girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoyle, and they said they would not take questions. So the gang, the mob then began chanting, USA, USA. And then they chant, but the maggots then changed it to Q&A, Q&A. And the 450 people who showed up, I mean, that's a sizable crowd, they were told that there wouldn't be a Q&A because of time constraints. And the primary group of pissed off maggots were so-called America Firsters. I may have been right the first time.
Yeah, you may have been. I think you were.
And they were angry because they weren't going to get to talk about how the Jews and internationalists and free traders and apologists for mass immigration. They weren't going to be able to ask him, how come it is your daddy's letting himself be run by them? Mm-hmm. And the shouting didn't go away. It just continued and continued and continued. And then a few minutes later, after he said, I'm willing to listen, and they shouted back, Q&A, Q&A. And Uday says, we'll go into the lion's den and talk. Then open the Q&A. And then Kimberly Guilfoyle tried to shame them. This is just too rich.
Yeah.
She said, you're not making your parents proud by being rude and disruptive. And then they ran away.
Jesus. Well, I sent you an email last night with something that I saw in my news feed. Speaking of books. Speaking of Trump and books, the public libraries up in Idaho, apparently, and yes, apparently they can read up there. I never knew this. But someone keeps badly misfiling the pro-Trump books and the pro-gun right books in the libraries up somewhere in Idaho. In other words, it's not...
Oh, I saw, yeah, right, yeah. Books bad.
It's just every new day presents opportunities for fun, Bob. And meanwhile, over on our side, we've got...
By fun, you mean drinking, right?
Well, yeah.
Like turpentine?
Yeah. Like anything that'll do it. That's whatever gets you through the night.
A little wood alcohol, I mean...
But meanwhile, on our side, the big news the other night was Michael Bloomberg. And I'm thinking, okay, have I taken the fentanyl? What the hell is going on here? We need him like we need something that we don't need.
Well,
you know, I mean, it was already contentious.
Sometimes you are profound.
It was contentious already. Okay. Just as it is, but now we've got new level. It's like Is it written somewhere? Did we sign a document so a couple of years ago that the Democrats will willingly never win another presidential election again ever? Do we really want to go down this path?
Well, I mean, that's the goal for the other side.
Well, yeah, but and I can see them being up to it. But damn it, you know, we're supposedly on our own team. I would win one for, if not the Gipper, for our side, people.
Yeah, but the thing is, we can't reach consensus on what that means, because some people think that means, you know, just by God nominate Joe Biden and win.
Yeah, like we need 4 more years or 8 more years of GOP light. I mean, that's what it amounts to. We had it for 8 years with Obama in the final analysis. You're not going to find a more raging moderate than Obama was in most meaningful ways. We had the prospect of it with Hillary in 2016. And now we want to compound the problem in our country and the world with the possibility of 4 years of Biden. I mean, and if I get this, certainly other people more learned and wise than I
don't know. We can't afford it, but we need to go. We need to, because you know, I'm having a hard time buying the multimillionaire media narrative about how if you go to South Carolina, you'll just find all this enthusiasm for Joe.
Well, and I saw that, you know, speaking of people that will appeal to black voters, one of the shows that I was watching the other day had a chart with 5 or 6 states and all the Democratic candidates listed by name. And I think there was a little thumbnail picture of each one of them. And then over the along the top row were the names of the states. And then in the columns were the percentages, according to the polls in these places, that these candidates supposedly are garnering if the election were to be held today. And down in single digits, and by single digits, I mean 2-3% single digits, was Senator Harris of California, who is a woman of color. And under the column for Michigan, instead of 2 or 3% behind Buttigieg, the Wall Street candidate, I might add, in the column for Michigan, under the name or next to the name Harris, was a 0. And Michigan is a very urban place in places.
It's, you know, on this program, it's okay to say there are lots of black folks in Michigan.
Well, yeah, there's lots of black folks in Michigan.
I kind of despise that urban moniker.
Well, I used to work for an urban station.
I know. As,
yeah, you know, yeah. Which is why
urban hits. Yes,
we can't. Yeah, we can't call it black music or race music or rhythm and blues, for God's sake, or soul music.
No, it's that hippity hoppity music.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, I got to wrap things up here, but I'm glad you helped me get an extra 30 minutes in this evening, because that means we're only behind by 30.
But let me ask you, it's the same sort of thing. I don't see the appeal to black folks presented by Biden. And apparently, if these polls are to be believed, especially in Michigan, I don't see Kamala Harris getting it done. So the answer must lie elsewhere, was my point, pretty much. Maybe the time of moderate has come and gone.
Some people explain the attraction in South Carolina. And remember, Hillary had the same firewall in South Carolina. And, you know, it's explained by some and on this program that it's a matter of, you know, when it comes to white politicians, and the African-American community. Oh, Jesus Christ. I wish somebody else would say this instead of me, because this feels like an awful lot like, you know, white splaining.
You're making an observation, Bob, as a professional commentator.
But it has been said on this program that when it comes to white politicians and African-American voters, it's all about the devil you know.
Well, yeah, there is some truth to that.
And the one article that I read earlier today had a woman who was, I forget if she was pro-Sanders or pro-Warren, but she said, I go into my community, and she was younger, and she said, okay, I want everybody here to tell me why you like Joe Biden. There's only one rule. You can't use the name Obama. And
there
she said,
go.
They get mad at me when I say that.
Well, we both know why. This is something in the new week that I know that the impeachment testimonies are going to be paramount as a topic. But I hope Lady B can write in or call in or Tracy or someone.
And take this on so we can do a little less white-splaining?
Look at this, because, yes, it is true that, you know, some people, white, black, and any other color, tend to go with the devil you know, okay? And I've never cared for that expression. But I think, shouldn't we broaden our horizons a bit? Rather than base our choices and decisions on a solitary thing that we know, why don't we take everything that's happened in the last 40 or 50 years from all areas and know that for a moment? This is stuff that we know. Put it into the equation and see what answer pops out on the little card with the little bell that goes ding. Because there's more to it than just relying. It's like Zig Ziglar, the motivational speaker, used to say, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten.
Yeah.
You know? And the times are terrible.
Or Einstein, who was slightly more pessimistic, who
yeah.
said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, yet expecting a different result.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the things have gotten to the point where we needn't go totally overboard and batshit crazy. I mean, the batshit futures are up, Bob. I mean, if you've got any spare money,
sell.
latch on to those batshit puts and calls, you know? But what I'm telling you is, like, we've got to really think this through in the less than a year that remains and not fuck it up, you know? We can have fun and get it done, but we can't fuck it up. Anyway, I know it's time. It's way past time to go. But thank you for indulging me.
And the thing is, you talk about sorting things out. No, never thank me. I appreciate the conversation. But we're very close to me having to go over the line and start into something that I was going to be talking about this evening had we had the full 3 hours. I'll just tease this.
Okay.
We've been talking about the utter necessity that I get health care and how we're possibly ever going to do that under the circumstances as they presently exist. Well, I did my due diligence over the weekend. I'm just going to say it ain't pretty. And I'll go one further and say it is, in fact, infuriating. And my experience, not that I'm anything special, but if it's happening to me, it's happening to others. I mean, it's a big country, so that's sort of statistically how it is. And we know what Darlene's already told us about what she goes through to have health care. After what I saw over this weekend, Scott, anybody who argues that we need to hang on to a profit-driven insurance system is either hopelessly ignorant, or, I dare say, hopelessly wicked.
Yeah, that pretty well sums it up, Bob.
and I'm about one synapse away from just going into it, but I'm not. It's been a long day. I'm tired. Ferg's in pain. Agnes has taken care of him, and I need to knock off here.
Okay, but let me tell you something, just to reassure you. You are more representative. You and your family's situation is more representative than you know in this country in terms of health care or lack of it, more accurately. So don't feel bad for standing up and saying so, because there's a definite problem, and there's been a definite problem for a definitely long time.
Well, and in my case, what I hope maybe listening to this, people will tune in and maybe share their stories so that we can sort of build a quantum of experience to show why we have to have Medicare for all. Because, you know, I did a deep dive. Because, again, I'm trying to do my due diligence. Because if I'm going to talk about raising the fundraising goal so I can have health insurance, it has to mean something, and there has to be health insurance. And what I found out is that second part, even if I buy the stuff, is almost impossible. I mean, it's breathtaking. And lo and behold, hey, West Virginia's got gold, silver, and bronze plans now. And they, well, see, I'm doing it. You're making me do it.
It is a topic and a conversation worth having.
Well, I feel like I'm being selfish in this because I'm talking about it from my own perspective. But the thing is, there are no multimillionaire for-profit media journalists out there who are talking about it for whom it means anything, because they're taken care of. They've got theirs. They never have to worry. But people who work for a living, middle class, lower middle class, anybody anywhere who can't get Medicaid is in this shit show.
Yeah.
Unless maybe you've got, you know, union health care, which we're constantly told is the fucking diamond and platinum standard. They call them Cadillac plans. Well, it sounds to me like a Cadillac plan would be a plan where you pay into it and you go to the doctor and you're not hammered with a bunch of copays, and it's just all paid for. That's as Cadillac as you can get. You know, fuck, that's a Bugatti plan.
Yeah.
Here's the funny thing. That's Medicaid. You get your services, you get your health care, and you got nothing out of pocket.
Yeah.
And that's also the vision they have for Medicare for all.
And they're apparently tightening that up.
Well,
they are, but who qualifies and who doesn't.
But when assholes like Joe Scarborough or Joke Toad or any of these other millionaires say, well, goddamn, it's going to cost $30 trillion. Yeah, they never said anything about the F-35. That's one.
Yeah.
And two, when you say it's going to cost $30 trillion, what you're saying is it's not worth $30 trillion to save a few thousand lives, a few tens of thousands of lives, that working people just don't have that much value in the American scheme of things.
Well, and another response is, yes, today, right now, given the situation, it may cost something approaching that number. But had we gone ahead back in, what, 48, 46?
Sure.
48?
Yeah, but I mean,
when
that,
Harry Truman
but that's,
first
that's,
proposed...
Yeah, but that's the quarter... That's the parlor game for people with bourbon in lead crystal glasses and corduroy jackets with leather elbow patches. It doesn't matter, Scott. What matters?
Yeah, but Bob, it does matter.
What is matter? No, because we don't have a time machine.
Yes, I know that. But for purposes of illustration, it matters. Yes, it is expensive now to address it in any meaningful way. And it needn't have been had we paid the small cost.
Right, and we have Republicans like Eisenhower and the Republican Congress to thank for that.
Well, bingo. Bingo.
But when I say it doesn't matter, what I'm saying is we got to be here now and go forward.
Yeah.
And we've got to say that the American people are worth more than what our millionaire betters think we are.
Yeah.
And moreover, we've somehow got to get better. And I it feels a little conspiracy-ish, frankly, Scott. But we've got to get better on getting the message out there into the mainstream, because these fuckers do not want to have people on their shows or on their air saying, look, yeah, it's $30 trillion, but how much of that gets balanced out by not supporting a billionaire class that's working on their 13th vacation home?
Yeah.
It may be $30 billion, but if your savings is $40 billion, it's a $10 billion gain.
And you know what? And people's memories are not that faulty. It was only 10, 11 years ago that we had the housing crisis. And if you watch a handful of dramatic films or documentaries about the people who brought us that fiasco, it's a lot of the same fucking people. And if not the same people, they have the people in the healthcare industry share the same mindset and values, I have in quotes there, as the people who gave us the housing and the banking and the Wall Street fiasco 11 years ago. There's not that much new material that we need to learn. It's the same fucking story. It's just different on the low end of people like us. It's just a different number, a different form of people who are getting fucked over, a different form of fucking, if you will. God, I didn't mean to get started, but it's a conversation worth having, Bob, because you're like, it's Howard Beale telling the nation, your life has value, man. You know?
Yeah. And that's the thing. And how dare a bunch of millionaires tell you, me, working America, that we're just not worth it to have Medicare for all. We're better off dead. Because that's what they're saying. I mean, is there any doubt about that? Can there be any doubt about that?
And people who are as in bad shape as you are, your family is, who vote repeatedly for these asshats, they're enablers. And they're getting screwed as badly or worse than any of us. And how crazy do you have to be to do that? Or blind? How ignorant and blind do you have to be to do that?
You're charitably leaving out stupid.
Well, I never know which one is the right word. Is ignorant the right word or is stupid?
Well, let's put it this way. Ignorant can be cured. Stupid you can't fix.
Yes, stupid is forever. But I don't envy you, Bob, but then again, I don't envy anybody. Everybody's ass is up for grabs in a certain segment of American society. And if you think it's bad here, there are places in the world that people are even worse off.
Well, you know,
there are places where people are way better off.
Yeah, but, well, look. We get emails from our buddy Robert in Australia who tells us about the Australian healthcare system. We have a lot of friends in Australia, and I specifically wanted to use a couple of minutes in this program to send out our best hopes that there's some sort of respite from the goddamn bushfires. It's like maybe they need to hang a banner from the Sydney Harbour Bridge that says, "Welcome to California."
Yeah.
Because Australia is now on fire because it's now summer or coming on summer. It's, you know, mid-spring in Australia, and both New South Wales and Queensland are under states of emergency, and there's 50-mile-an-hour winds that are going to blow south to north that may just set it all alight. There's already a couple of people dead, countless acres burned. The worst they've known was 2009, and this is looking like it could possibly surpass that. And there, and you know, if you're in Australia, there you sit with a prime minister who thinks that, you know, just like this jackass in the White House, that climate change is some sort of joke or hoax or practical joke that's being played on humanity because we want to be mean to the poor put upon fucking oil companies. So if it's anywhere near you, well, I mean, I harbor the typical, perhaps more than typical, American soft spot for our Australian friends. It's one of my bucket lists to go down there and or up over there or whatever. It depends on how you think about space, and just hang out with some really nice people for a while. Hell, wouldn't it be fun to do the program from down from there?
Oh wow.
And you know, the idea, and it is, and ever since white folks got there, has been such a fragile ecosystem. You know, the asshole upper crust Englishman who simply couldn't do without being able to hunt rabbits, so they brought rabbits to Australia, and rabbits just about ate Australia out of house and home.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Ferg was pointing out to me the other day that West Virginia is one of the few states where it's not illegal to own a kangaroo. He wants to fly to Australia and smuggle a little Joey home.
There's your health care plan, Bob.
And raise him as his lifelong friend.
Get you a boxing kangaroo and charge $1 a piece to come in and see. You get that premium in no time. Come on.
I don't know how we get to these places, but my thoughts and the thoughts of the Horn Family Community Congregation are with folks in Australia, because it's awful and it's terrifying and it's California redux. It's almost like the planet's trying to balance itself by, okay, Northern Hemisphere catches fire, let's burn somewhere in the South. And then just from the, because science is cool, while we were waiting on Ferg to come out today, I watched via NASA, some subsection thereof, I watched Mercury transit the face of the sun.
Oh, yes. And it only happens, what, about 13 times a century?
And the next one won't be till 2049 that we can see. And so that was just cool. And I thought immediately of... And what a visionary he was. I thought of Kurt Vonnegut, who so damn long ago, and it was actually the first Kurt Vonnegut book that I read, because I grew up in a time where we had a fully stocked library in my junior high school. I was one of the librarians, and I got to read all kinds of stuff, anything I wanted to. And some days I could just sit there and read late into the evening. And the first Kurt Vonnegut book I ever read, and this school only went through eighth grade, and we had Kurt Vonnegut, and nobody was, you know...
How'd that happen?
Nobody was protesting, nobody was screaming. Well, because where I grew up in Alabama in that time was still a place that prided itself on its educational system,
yeah,
and its open-mindedness. Because we were a scientific community. And I read The Sirens of Titan.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, The Sirens of Titan, at one point in time, Malachi Constant, by then known as Unk, lives in a cave on Mercury amongst the Harmoniums, who are the only life form on the planet Mercury. And they glow, and they cling to the walls, and I think they feed on emotion or something. But, you know, he was envisioning, and so I thought of Kurt Vonnegut today as Mercury was passing across the face of the sun.
Yeah.
People like Kurt Vonnegut are enough to make you wish there really was a heaven. Because it would be kind of, but you know, all you know, if there was all those dead souls up there going, dude, I loved you, and you know, Kurt Vonnegut's just sitting there smoking a Chesterfield, going, fuck off, go away. No,
he was a Paul Mall man.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, that's right. He was a Paul Mall man.
Oh God.
So that.
Well, listen. I am glad.
And
I
get well. And get well soon, Jimmy Carter.
He broke his hip or something,
well,
or pelvis?
He's had so many falls that he's been admitted to the hospital in Atlanta, and they're doing surgery to relieve a bleed on his brain that's the result of all the falls. No statement as to his condition. I wish I was a praying guy. I'd be praying for him if I was. But as it is, I will simply hope that the universe chooses to let him outlive both the Trump administration and Donald Trump, so that Trump can't filthy up his funeral.
Yeah, that's all we need. God. Well, I'm telling you, Bob, it's going to be an interesting year. Looking ahead, I picked
a bad time to and by the way,
how is that smoking deal going?
This was not the day. I tried, I failed. Yeah. But you know, yeah. I may have to kickstart it a couple of times, but I'm going to get there. But you know, having to get up early, worrying about Ferg, you know, it's like, nope, sorry. Mm-mm. So.
Yeah, you want you want conditions on all levels to be as favorable as they can be, because you're going to be stressed enough initially for the first 5 to 10 days, okay?
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, just in case there's anybody out there who does copywriting for things like nicotine patches.
It's a machine, I think.
Oh, no, it pissed me off. Because they're trying to give you these tips and tricks for getting through those first few difficult days, and one of the things says, think about how much more attractive non-smokers are than a dirtbag like you, Bob.
Oh God.
think about how non-smokers don't stink like you stink. Think about how they're not poisoning their children like you are, you asshole, you. I mean, I'm expanding on it a little bit, but it was really snide. And I checked in with Agnes, because these things I always check in with Agnes. And I said, hey, honey, I'm just going to read this to you. You know, didn't say anything one way or the other. I said, just listen to this. And I read the passage to her, and she went, well, fuck. Where's the paragraph about think about how nasty self-righteous pricks are? And it reminded me of something that Tom Robbins once wrote, you know, the guy who did Even Cowgirls Get the Blues and Still Life with Woodpecker, early 80s, really popular. He said, a woman once looked at me and said, did you know that kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray? And he said, I responded to her, did you know that kissing a self-righteous person is like licking a mongoose's ass? And I haven't yet gotten around to calling the quit line so I can get put on hold and have them because this goes back to one of the earliest horn programs. I was trying back then, and I had the patch on, and I was freaking out. And so it was a weekend, and I called, and you know, because I called, call the nicotine quit line. We're here to help. Hello, thank you for calling the nicotine quit line. This line is open during regular business hours from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. if you're calling during those times, someone will be with you shortly, and it cuts over to hold. Now, of course, this was on the weekend, but it cuts over to hold, and all of a sudden my old DJ brain is going, wait a minute, I recognize the hold music. Na, 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 na. Na, 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 na. And I remember looking at Agnes and screaming, oh, my God, honey, The hold music for the nicotine quit line is please don't talk about me when I'm gone.
Oh, yeah.
You assholes. You bastards.
Well, when you were humming it, I thought that's what it was, but I didn't make the connection. But yeah, that is sort of dickish.
And then there are the instructions
to put on
like
your weekend hold music.
Place patch on a hairless part of your body. I guess I'm going to have to go get a full body wax. I don't have any hairless parts of my body, unless it's like the roof of my goddamn mouth. I got less hairless parts of my body now than I did, well, except for the, okay, I can put it on the top of my head. Damn sure can't put it on my eyebrows or ears. So,
see, I forewent the patch. To me, the gum is more like smoking in the sense that you pop a piece when you need a piece. And didn't you say you had intestinal issues from it?
Oh, yeah.
I think that has to do with chomping too vigorously.
Yeah, well, I mean, there can be, and there can be nausea, blood pressure issues, all of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, see, the patch always frightened me because my friend Pat Richardson, the radio guy in Tulsa, the right-wing radio guy in Tulsa, who I love dearly just as a person. I hate his politics, but he's a nice person. Smoked those Carlton cigarettes. It was like less than a half of a milligram of nicotine
or
something.
Yeah, less than a cigarette. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, yeah. So old Pat had the weakest patch that you could get, and he was having fucking dizzy spells. So he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, Pat, the patch is giving you more nicotine than a whole pack of your Carlton's did. So he didn't know. I don't know how he resolved that. Maybe he went back to smoking or something. But, well, now, see, they've got the lozenge.
Yeah, but the other thing is there's this when they're telling you how to use the patches, there's this one passage where they say if you smoke less than 10 cigarettes per day, start with step 2. I'm like, if you smoke less than 10 cigarettes a day, you're not a smoker.
No, you're a
hobbyist. You probably just bum them off of people at cocktail parties, you fuck.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the lab
SE guys cigarettes, somebody else's.
At Glasgow or at Glaxo or whatever the company is that makes these products, the gum and the patch and the lozenge, sooner or later they're going to have a nicotine suppository, which ought to work for a number of
us. You know, you keep coming back to the suppository, Scott. You're beginning to worry me.
Well, what can I tell you? I read a lot or something. I don't know, Bob. I'm right now as we've been chatting. I've had a piece of Nicorette in my mouth. I still use it. I like having a little nicotine in my system because it makes nice with the little receptors inside of my brain, and I don't have to light anything and subject my body.
And it obviously contributes to the sparkling conversationalist that you are.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's, you know, but I have my coffee in the morning and a couple of pieces of gum and a few pieces during the course of the day or the evening or whatever. And I'm, politics notwithstanding, I'm a relatively tranquil, happy human being, you know?
Yep. Well, hey, we turned it into a 3-hour program after all. Look at us.
With hardly any effort at all, Bob. Which...
Yeah, nobody out there taking the podcast is going to know the difference. I'll have to edit out all the references to the power outage. Scott, have a good night, my friend.
I will. You too, Bob, and best to Ferg and the rest of the family, and best to the Horn family around the world.
Why?
It's an important group of people, I would think. Because you guys have got it going on, you've got it on the ball, and it's a better planet with you on it, and we will be able to fashion ourselves a future that works for all concerned, that works positively and appropriately for all concerned. But we've got to just put one foot in front of the other and chomp on our gum or slap on our patch and just keep moving onward and upward. So there.
This has been Words from Unity. The horn is... See you, Scott.
Bob, goodbye.
Bye. And just on the way out the door, for the sake of the giggle, Mike in Cascadia reminded me of this.
Hey, buddy.
Hi.
Hey, you should come over. Tonight's pipe night.
Look at your face! It looks like an old catcher's mitt.
Face is all craggly. It's crinkly. It's from all that smoke. You've experienced a lifetime of smoking in 72 hours. What did you expect? Well, emphysema, birth defects, cancer, but not this. Jerry, you know, my face is my livelihood. Well, everything I have, I owe to this face. It's my allure, my twinkle.
You know. Your teeth are all brown.
Look away, I'm hideous.
Look away, I'm hideous, yes. Think about how you won't stink. All right, we turned this into a, and thank you, Jim. Jim noting, get well, President Carter. Hear, hear. We got a 3-hour program in after all. So thanks, everybody. Fundraising goal tomorrow evening will be $640. And thanks to Anatole and Barry for jumping in this evening. Thanks so very much. Much appreciated. And I will. I'll go into the healthcare thing tomorrow because it's beyond the broad philosophical principles that Scott and I touched on. Jesus. The simple realities of what constitutes insurance in this country, or at least in this state in which I live, the term that you will see in the law from time to time is it shocks the conscience. So there we go. Thanks again to Anatole and Barry. Thank you to all of our subscribers. Thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this program, howsoever you choose to do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky for coming into the chat room and moderating when he realized that there was going to be a program after all. Hey, thanks to Appalachian Power for only having their grid crash for, 45 minutes or so. It's probably all a warm-up for what's going to happen tomorrow when the temperatures drop to 13 in November. 13, yeah. Well, that must mean there ain't no climate change. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.